Hi, thanks. Yep, so I am here to talk about autism, but I'm going to start, like I start all my talks about autism, because sometimes people don't know what autism really is. It's a behaviorally defined neurodevelopmental disorder, and there's a triad of features that characterize it. Behaviorally defined is important, right? We don't have a blood test, we don't have anything to give us a fingerprint and say, this person has autism. But social impairments, speech and communication deficits, and repetitive behaviors and restricted interests are how we currently define autism. You'll notice that even though I'm giving a talk about eye movements are not in here, okay? but in fact, actually, when Kanner identified, he first described autism in 1943, he noted many of the people that he initially described as having serious motor deficits, some hypotonia, some clumsiness difficulties. So ever since 1943, we've known that motor features are a part of what we call autism. And more recently, people have begun to rediscover, if you will, this phenomenon in a multitude of ways. From saccadic and smooth pursuit eye movements, I'll be talking about saccades a bit today, to early developmental motor delays, here from Becky Landa and her colleagues. And then we have some other more complicated movements, like measurements of dyspraxia. And then this is a particularly interesting study because they're attempting to use a whole battery of movement to try to show that movement goes with the diagnosis and not necessarily with genetic relatedness. So these were monozygotic and dizygotic twins. So this person is arguing very strongly for the inclusion of motor features in the diagnosis based on some genetic type findings. So, but not yet. What you likely have heard about with respect to movements in autism is that gaze behavior is atypical when you're looking at faces. This has been shown and known for a while. This particular picture, which I took to illustrate that fact, comes from Omni Klin's data. I think this particular image is from the 2002 paper where he's showing adults with autism spectrum disorder a little video clip from Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? And this is a particularly moving or dynamic scene where there's this intense gaze between the two individuals in the picture. And a typical individual here shown in yellow tends to look back and forth between the eyes in this video, whereas the individual with autism tends to look elsewhere, like between the mouth and the chin, and maybe attracted by that necklace over there. So, point being that in very dynamic, realistic settings, this gaze doesn't seem to be typical in individuals with autism. So, I'd like to note that we have later Marnie talking about the other thing that seems to be atypical in autism, and that their faces might not be making the same kinds of features and gestures that individuals who are typical with, and like to know how those things go together with the eye movements. Okay, there's been a lot of reports of this. You see it less often when you're not in a natural setting and when there's nothing dynamic, but we know relatively little about what causes it. There are some guesses. There's misdevelopment of subcortical face processing, maybe involving the amygdala, maybe involving fear. There's been a lot of recent research trying to look at early development of this. In fact, some showing that it doesn't start that way. The most recent research suggesting that it seems to be typical up until a point and then goes off track. But we don't really have a great sense for why this develops. And so I'm going to suggest a favorite interpretation that starts with the basics, right? So let's really start with, are saccades okay all by themselves, right? So this is as simple as a saccad task comes. If I asked you to direct your gaze from this cross, when there was nothing on the screen, to this little Cheerio, when it popped up and it appeared in your visual periphery, you'd likely orient to it very quickly and very accurately. If I asked you to do this repeatedly, you'd probably do it just as well the next time, and the next time, and the next time. It's a very, very simple, straightforward task. And you do it automatically. You're not consciously aware of your movements in this regard. You make these movements about 3 to 4 times a second without being aware of it. So, good thing that it works, and it certainly ought to work. We want this to work. But what if it doesn't work efficiently? And in individuals with autism, it sometimes doesn't. So in this very task, we measured about 20 people with ASD and 25 typical developing kids. And we see that both in terms of time to initiate cicad, cicadic latency, and cicadic error, so where the first cicad landed in this very simple task, there is a significant difference between individuals with ASD and typically developed individuals. Okay, well, that's interesting. What I think is, but I told you that other people were sort of hovering around this aspect, but what I wanted to drive home is that this isn't an attentional task, this is a very simple exogenous task. When we did this, it was part of a larger study to study other types of movements as well. And in fact, it was part of a battery. We called it a dyspraxia battery, but what I'm going to show you is not a dyspraxia movement. We measured this. It's about as simple as it gets. How many times can you do this in 60 seconds? We also video coded it, so what we noticed when people did this and then this, and then when they were very irregular, right? As it turns out, that was actually a really nice thing to notice. Gene noticed. And we split the data in this regard. And this is what we found. That the huge effect was actually carried by the kids who were irregular here and not so much by the kids who were not. So the significant difference here is actually between the typical and the irregular moving. And this is about half of the population, a little more than actually are irregular than irregular. And particularly is an effect in accuracy. Okay, so we know that these, yes?
So was that throughout the 60 seconds or did it change? Did they start off okay and then kind of fade or?
I don't think we particularly made that kind
that
of,
might be really important to look
that
at.
Difference.
60 seconds is a long time.
60 seconds is a long time. It was variable. The ones who were irregular were may have started out. It's hard to tell when you start because you haven't established your rhythm yet. Mm-hmm. But the ones who are irregular were irregular throughout, starting early in the process.
Yep.
What's the accuracy measure? What are the degrees here?
So degrees of visual angle for the subject. So 1.5, 2.5. Degrees of visual angle in the eye movement. So this is, sorry. I am breaking out, this is the cicad task still. And I'm just breaking out the ASD group based on whether or not you were rhythmic or not rhythmic. I'm sorry, I didn't make that clear in this task, okay? So clearly body movements more generally are having some effects on eye movements and that there's something larger going on. Okay, so, and this is the hypothesis that I'd like to put forth, right? That these very low level movements are going to have effects developmentally in higher level cognitive and perhaps also social tasks and that we should be thinking about it in that way. And in order to get at that, the first type of paradigm that we looked at was a change blindness paradigm, because this is something where we have nice psychophysical control. It's a little more natural in terms of we get a lot of eye movements for the kids to make. We can make a social manipulation and a non-social manipulation and see what we see in terms of movement. So here's an example of how the task went. There was a fixation cross, and then there was a static image presented for 6 seconds, and then the image started to flip. So there were 16 images total. Each one was shown twice, so for a total of 32 images. And the image would either flip to a social variant, see this child's head move from here to here, or it would, on a separate trial, flip from the original to a non-social variant where what changed was something non-social. Now I'll get to how I picked those changes in just a minute, but I want you to appreciate that the flip was always from here to here, or in a different trial from here to here. Yeah? Okay. And we did it in a special way that I need to thank Mike Moser for, because it actually worked really well. We wanted to make sure that the kids, because this can be a hard task, it's a fun task. The kids had more fun doing this than anything we've given them in a while. They would jump out of their chair and hit the button, screwing up my eye tracking. But they liked it. But we made it so that there was like a 150 millisecond gap between the switches at first, and then that gap slowly decreased. So you were bound to get it at the end, right? We gave them a full second, full minute to get this. And if they didn't get it, we give them a hint, and they'd tell us where it is. So what happened? Well, as it turns out, there was no difference in reaction time overall between groups, autism versus non. But if I looked at the social versus non-social reaction time, the kids with autism actually did have a a difference in their reaction time versus the typical kids. So it took longer for the typical kids to find the non-social change than the autism kids. It took them longer to find the social change, right? But overall, there was no difference between the groups in terms of finding it, generally speaking. There was a tremendous difference in the kids with autism in terms of their variability. And that's something we find regularly. Okay. So I wanted to tell you a little bit about how we made these images and how we analyzed them, because a former trainee from the TDLC, Chris Kanon, was very heavily involved in this. And he actually passed all of our images through his salience model. And so we get these resulting salience maps, and it allowed us to ask a couple of questions. Well, first of all, we use the salience maps to choose locations on the screen to change. And so the relatively similar eccentricity, size, and salience of a social bit and a non-social bit. Okay. But then it also allowed us to ask, do individuals with autism inspect a scene differently with respect to image salience? And actually the answer was, by and large, no, they didn't. Except when you consider the order of their fixations. They were hitting all the same places, but they were hitting them differently. And this was our first hint that, okay, you know, if when you're exploring a scene, maybe you're gonna get all the top places, but you're not gonna necessarily prioritize them similarly. And this is hinting at the face processing bit. You know, you're getting some information from the scene, but you're not necessarily looking at the faces in the same way or at the same rate. So this was just a comparison of order information, with order information, without order information. But what this did for me is set up the need to work with Janet Wiles and her recurrence plots and really take a look at sequences more rigorously. So we want to examine saccade trajectory. So on this snowball scene, I've superimposed a typical child's saccadic eye movements. And so he starts in the center and he looks at the snowball and he looks back and forth between the child and the man who's throwing the snowball and this person in the periphery. But in particular, he spends a lot of time looking here. And these three fixations are what we'd say are recurrent within what would be a 2-degree window for the child viewing this image. Okay, so really spending a lot of time going back and looking at that man. Recurrence is actually a bit of a bear, and I'm looking forward to spending some time with Janet to learn more about how to analyze this. But this is actually a plot of, if I were to take all of these eye movements and I plot the distance between these fixations, okay, all of them for the two times that an individual saw that same image, I would get this as global recurrence, where the warmer colors are showing me longer distances between fixation, and the cool colors, and particularly dark blue, being like you went back to exactly the same spot. So you can see that there's a lot of structure and a lot of difference between these two individuals looking at the snowball image. The child here with autism has a lower recurrence, goes back less often than the child on the right. You can also get numbers out of these, which is one of the things I like about it. It's very quantitative. We can threshold it. We could go back to that circle here and draw a circle around every fixation and say, okay, if I want to threshold it now with, say, a 2 degrees of visual angle, I can create a plot like this. Show me all the movements that went back to within 2 degrees. And now that's how I can get these two measures. Okay. Yes?
So if you had two different typically developing children, how similar would those two look?
Good question. So the typically developing children certainly looked more like each other than the children with autism. In fact, what I want to tell you is that there was a trend for things like this to happen, that the kids with autism were less recurrent, right? It was not significant in this population. And I'm not sure why, but I'm quite sure that what is significantly different was that the autism population was wildly variable. Okay, and that's across all images and comparing groups. I want to wrap up by showing you that you can also, yes.
In your previous slide, do those results depend on whether that's in the social or not?
So there's all of these scenes have social elements in them.
That's
That's interesting. I didn't do that. I mean, I should rank my scenes on sociality, perhaps, and then we can see that. But I'm going to tell you one way in which I think there's a difference. And that's this particular image was the one image that had a significant difference in recurrence between groups. ASD, again, had a lower recurrence. And what's interesting about this group, this image, is that far and away, it had the largest amount of detail, high spatial frequency content, right? And we know that individuals with autism are actually quite good at processing detail. And this, to me, is now a nice clue for a next step. Because if you can process, handle all this detail and not go back, you're looking for something, you're looking for a change, but you're not going back to the same spot again and again. You just got it on the first time. You know, that's interesting, but it also means that maybe you're not putting the emphasis on integration. And we know that there seems to be problems in integration in autism. We have, I'm happy to see Keith Rayner is here. I think one of his papers also points at a lack of integration of content in images and people shown to people with autism. And we're working on some other studies where we think that integration is actually the problem. So the question is this trend toward lower recurrence a mark of weak integration specifically? And if so, can we train better visual integration? And I ask it that way because we're actually our immediate next steps are stepping toward the social aspect. So there's a demo tonight, and I highly recommend you guys visit. Nikita Lowell is here, and Monique Lee, who I'm not sure is here yet, are going to be demonstrating this dual gaze interaction tonight. And we're also doing game-based interventions to improve gaze behavior. And what we are working on right now is just simple directed saccades, visual search, and speed. But I think we might also be able to step past that and work toward some sort of integrative pulling together of information in order to solve a problem in autism in our future games. And that would be a next step. I look forward to your comments, and I want to thank the folks here, Rad Lab, being prominent as well as work is done, and then the collaborators from the TDLC.